This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mel Gedroych here. I'm just after a moment of your time before you listen to this podcast. Now, this Christmas, thousands of people across the UK will be without a safe place to call home. But listen up, you can help change that. St Martin's helps ensure that people experiencing homelessness can find and keep a safe place to live. Your gift could help support somebody to take the next step towards a more secure future. Please support the BBC Radio 4 Christmas Appeal with St Martin in the Fields by donating online on the Radio 4 website. Together we can help bring people a step closer to home. I thank you. Now go on, enjoy your podcast.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It's the cyberspace where you, me, the top experts, and 28 minutes converge to understand one of the big issues. And this week, 4 months on, what's happening in Taliban-run Afghanistan? Last August, the government of Afghanistan collapsed and the Taliban returned to power. What had been a 20-year insurgency has had to morph into a government running a country. So how is that going? And if the answer is very badly, what can be done about it? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with what's going on the ground. The briefing room's John Murphy spoke to Sukunda Kamani, the BBC's man in Kabul.
What is the picture on the ground at the moment in Afghanistan?
But look, if you walk around, the signs of everyday life are inevitably continuing. Shops and markets are open, there are cars on the street, though it is still quieter than before the Taliban takeover. Of course, you see Taliban members wherever you go. They're either in Kabul guarding government buildings or just moving through the city. Sometimes they're in smart, camouflage-coloured versions of Afghan traditional clothes. Others are without a uniform, but driving in vehicles captured from the former police and army. The signs of the economic crisis this country is experiencing are pretty much everywhere too. Businesses say there are far fewer customers than usual. There are more people begging on the streets. You get long queues outside banks because there are limits on cash withdrawals. And you see far fewer women than before too, particularly far fewer younger women, although this is something that's really relevant to Kabul and other big cities, less to more rural areas. Those women that are out and about in Kabul are dressed more conservatively than they were under the previous government. Back then, they would perhaps have a hijab covering their hair, but might also wear jeans. There's a lot less of that now. Having said that, you do still see some women out and about, and they're certainly not being made to wear the all-encompassing burqa that was, of course, the big symbol of the Taliban's regime in the 1990s. The vast majority of women have been told that they can't go back to work, and girls in secondary schools in most of the country have also not been allowed to go back to the classroom just yet. Some suggestion they might be able to do that after the winter break, but also a degree of scepticism about Taliban promises around that.
And what about issues like hunger, you know, particularly maybe in the countryside? Do you see any signs of that?
Well, malnutrition is rising. It's a really serious issue. I mean, I was in Kandahar, it's a southern city, just last week, and I met a doctor who I had last met around 2 years ago. And back then, he was dealing with non-stop amputations of people who had been badly injured in the war. Now he said that that's all come to an end, but the hospital is receiving a really significant increase in malnourished young children and their mothers. The situation was always bad in Afghanistan. I mean, even last winter, there were around 18 million people who were assessed to be at acute levels of food insecurity. That figure's now risen to 23 million, the highest since records began, but it gives you an idea that this was a country that has long been struggling. now that much of the international presence has been withdrawn, things are in free fall in a way.
And do you get a sense from ordinary Afghans about how they feel about what's going on? Do they actually speak up and tell you?
People are still speaking quite frankly, certainly in private. I mean, if you try and put a camera in front of someone, then of course they're more reticent. But in everyday conversation, people still feel that they can express their views about the Taliban. Many are critical about them. Yeah, I don't think the Taliban are particularly popular, but in a way they don't need that. What they need is acquiescence. And there were a lot of people who were also fed up with the rampant corruption of the previous government. And if you go to more rural areas where people were living along these fluid front lines, well, people there are just simply glad that the war is over. And there are large parts of the country, particularly in the south, which is dominated by the Pashtun ethnicity, where people's worldviews are broadly in tune with the kind of conservative or ultra-conservative views of the Taliban, at least on some issues. But other people, particularly in bigger cities, they really feel as if this country is being dragged back 20 years. And that's why so many people are trying to find a way out. I mean, I was in a people smuggling hub in the southwest of the country around a month ago, and there was around 4,000 to 5,000 people at least every day being smuggled out, many hoping to get eventually to the West. But this economic crisis really at the moment is the most pressing issue for people. If you had a government job before, if you were a healthcare worker or a teacher, you likely haven't been paid for around 4 or 5 months now. Many of them are still going to work despite that. But of course, life has become increasingly difficult. And that's why we're actually seeing issues like hunger spread from remote rural areas where they've long been an issue to affecting people who were living in cities, who were living perhaps more middle-class lives. If you speak to any doctor or anyone working in a health clinic, whether it's in a big city or in a more rural area, they're saying that they're seeing scenes that they haven't seen before, and it's a really distressing situation.
Sukunda Kamani. To the outsider looking at the pictures, the new government in Kabul just looks like a collection of men with big beards surrounded by others with machine guns. But what's really going on at the centre of power? Who's actually in charge? Dr. Mike Martin is visiting fellow in the War Studies Department of King's College London and author of An Intimate War, An Oral History of the Conflict in Helmand Province. Mike Martin, who is actually in the Taliban government and what do they represent?
It's a good question, David. We in the West, in the UK and Europe, tend to view the Taliban as a homogenous organisation. But just like any political party, there are different factions. And what's been really clear since the fall of Kabul in the middle of August and the process of the government formation, two clear factions have arisen in the Taliban. One group's around the Haqqani network that some of your listeners might have heard of. Those guys are on the terrorism watch list. And another group around a group of southerners. And those really are the sort of original Taliban, if you like, from the early 90s. And these two organizations, the Haqqanis are more closely linked to Pakistan, the Southerners are more closely linked to Iran, have been vying for power within the newly formed Taliban government.
How do they get on?
Really badly, actually. It's the new Kremlinology, watching what's going on in the presidential palace, the Arg in Kabul. So we've had fist fights and gunfights between the factions that ended up with a whole bunch of people in hospital and some dead. We've had office invasions. That particular one was over the cricket board, about who was going to be head of the Afghan cricket board. It's been an extraordinary display of disunity.
Insofar as the government is coherent, how far does its remit run? Side Kabul, are people waiting to hear what the government has to say and what it rules and then implementing it?
What the Taliban are doing at the moment, what they've been going through since the beginning of September, is a process of moving from a polycentric insurgency, so lots of different power centres. And that was totally necessary to survive the last 20 years of being targeted by some of the world's biggest, most technologically advanced armies. But of course, now they're a government and they need to be hierarchical. Governments are hierarchical. And so they're going through this process of moving from one to the other. the question is, to what degree does the warlord in that district, how far will they implement the policies of the central government? And that remains to be seen, because we've got some factions and we've also got the Taliban being outflanked on their right by Islamic State. It's not clear to the degree to which the Taliban are a cohesive, centralized government that's able to exert its will across the whole territory of Afghanistan. Now, I want to put that into context. It's normal for governments in Afghanistan to not control their territory. In fact, the last time that we had a government in Afghanistan that controlled the entire territory was 1978. So I wouldn't say that the current Taliban government controls any more or any less of the territory of Afghanistan than, say, the previous Republic of Afghanistan government that collapsed on August the 15th.
Are there significant objectives that the government has set?
Not in the traditional sense. There are huge areas of the policy cupboard, if you like, that are totally bare. I mean, counterterrorism. The Minister of the Interior is on a global terrorism watch list, and he's meant to be responsible for counterterrorism. I think actually at the moment, more important for the Taliban, as with any political organisation, is they're trying to maintain cohesion because of the transitions they're going to from being an insurgency to being a government to having these two factions. It's very hard for them actually to keep the organisation cohesive and to stop branches of the organisation peeling off and becoming opposition. And of course, in Afghanistan, everyone's armed. So movement cohesion of the Taliban is of vital importance, is far more important than any policies.
And Al-Qaeda is no longer a force?
We haven't heard much from them. I certainly haven't, speaking to my various contacts in Afghanistan, also analysts of the region. Al-Qaeda no longer are a force or seem to be a force, which, you know, if you go back to the original war aims of the coalition, I guess that's a tick. Although, obviously, we can't claim that the war turned out the way that America and Britain wanted it to.
Do you think that the Taliban is going to survive in power?
Thanks, David, for asking me to make a prediction on national radio. I would put the chances of disintegration and at least localised civil war at about 50% during 2022.
That's not a great prospect.
No, it's a complete disaster. Obviously, a total disaster for the Afghans that the war that started in 1978 is merely entering another cycle. So that's appalling. It's a disaster for the region because the regional countries don't have the infrastructure or ability to deal with the inevitable convulsions and refugee crises and so on and so forth. And it's going to be a problem for Europe. In October, 300,000 people, and these are credible figures, 300,000 people left Afghanistan via one border crossing in the southwest in Nimruz to head into Iran, to head to Europe. So next spring, we're probably going to see another migrant crisis in Europe. The smugglers in southwestern Afghanistan, the people smugglers who get people across that border into Iran, are reporting that they have twice as many people crossing this year as they did in 2014.
Mike Martin on the new rulers and their outlook. Joining me now in the briefing room to analyse the various crises in Afghanistan, their implications, and how the international community should react are three experts who we last brought together just a couple of days before Kabul fell. Laurel Miller is the director of the International Crisis Group's Asia programme. Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistani journalist and author who has studied the Taliban for decades. And Ashley Jackson is co-director of the Centre for the Study of Armed Groups at the global affairs think tank ODI. Ahmed Rashid, we've heard about the internal political strains for the Taliban in building their government. So let's start with Afghanistan's current enormous economic and supply problems. Now, in the first instance, what's causing them?
It's a complete collapse of the government, of the administration. Plus, there's a massive drought. It hasn't rained. The crops have failed. The economy has come to a standstill. And because of that, the flow of food and humanitarian aid, etc., has been much reduced. There's a very chronic situation. I've been told repeatedly the last couple of days that it's no good just talking about the humanitarian needs, because that can only be a temporary stopgap. You're going to have to try and get the economy moving again so that people have income and they have jobs and work, etc.
Laurel Miller, when we talked about this last time, one of the things we noted was that the Taliban had been good at taxing people on the border in order to raise money for the war, but actually might find it extremely difficult to raise money for government. Is that prophecy essentially being fulfilled?
That's right. I mean, the last government of Afghanistan, the one that collapsed as of August 15th, was very heavily supported by external resources, by foreign donors. About three quarters of public spending was supplied by foreign donors. So notionally, I think you could say maybe they could, once the economy is moving again, raise about a fourth of the money that the last government raised. That would seem a notionally replaceable amount of money. But there's the other three quarters that they don't have access to right now. And the consequence of the factors that Ahmed just outlined, the aid cutoffs, the seizure of Afghanistan's foreign assets, including its central bank reserves, the sanctions that are still in effect that are now not just imposed upon the Taliban, but choking the entire Afghan economy. All of that means that the economy is not functioning right now. They're not able to raise even that notional, you know, one quarter of the budget that the last government was able to, and they don't have access to the other three quarters. And so the consequences, you're seeing the banking system collapse, you're seeing people not have access as a result to cash, to buy food, hunger is increasing. You know, the UN humanitarian officials, they have never seen such a rapid collapse of an economy and descent into a humanitarian disaster as we're witnessing in Afghanistan right now.
Ashley Jackson, does that mean that the entire Afghan economy is aid dependent?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not only aid dependency, though. I think we really have to back up and kind of look at the sanctions regime, which, you know, was targeted to stop the Taliban from retaking power effectively. It didn't do that. But now that the Taliban is in power, those sanctions and the sort of seizure of central bank assets, it's basically cutting off the oxygen to Afghanistan. You know, the international community has their foot on the neck of the Afghan economy.
Ahmed, is there any sign that the Taliban government has any strategy for dealing with these problems?
Well, I think that's another major problem. There's a complete lack of governance at the moment from the Taliban. They haven't enunciated any policy apart from telling the West, give us the $9 billion that is lying with the IMF and the World Bank, and they're not likely to get that money soon. So they are very impatient, but they have not been able to come up with any kind of plan. But it must be said also that the international community has also been failing, that if we're now 4 months into the Taliban occupation in Afghanistan, and we still don't have a plan from the European countries, from the United States in particular, as to how they intend to feed and send humanitarian aid into the country. So, you know, I mean, both sides, there's a lack of clear thinking of policy, and it's not been very helpful.
Laurel, I want to come precisely to what other countries can, would, should do. But sticking for the moment to the question about the Taliban itself, do you discern any strategic approach by the Taliban to solving or to trying to solve these problems?
No, I don't. I think we see certain moves that they are very clearly making. One is that they continue to place a very high priority on keeping their own supporters happy, or in particular, the fighters and the commanders. And that is priority number one for the Taliban. Keep the supporters happy, maintain their internal cohesion, consolidate their grip on power. That's not a strategy for helping the people of Afghanistan or for governing. It is a strategy for staying in power. With respect to the financial resources, what we see is they are shifting blame to the foreign powers, enabled by the foreign powers, in fact, having some responsibility here because it was their decisions that contributed to bringing Afghanistan to the current situation that it's in. But it's convenient for the Taliban to shift blame and say, it's not our fault that our country is starved of resources. All that happened is we won the war. Why are you penalizing Afghanistan for the fact that you lost the war?
Ashley Jackson, one major compounding factor here is the hardline policies of the Taliban, not least on women and minorities. As far as you can discern, is there any sign that the Taliban is willing to moderate those policies in order to achieve a better situation?
Yes, in their own way, they've tried to reach out. They've tried to say, okay, look, when schools reopen, they're on a break right now, but when they reopen after the winter break, you know, all girls' schools at secondary level will be open. We need to hold them to that commitment. And we need to establish a mechanism to keep dialogue going to ensure that, you know, bit by bit, we increase women's freedom and access. Now, the problem, which we've just talked about, is that the Taliban are in over their head. They are facing a crisis of the magnitude of which any government would be struggling with. But let's be honest, the Taliban are not terribly competent bureaucratically. They aren't ready for this. Certainly, they have no plan. And I think they're really struggling to figure out and to understand what the international community wants them to do. The problem is that the international community is making a lot of non-specific, unrealistic demands. There's no real dialogue in terms of a roadmap to sort of getting through this and moderating, if you can, moderating the Taliban's behavior.
Ahmed.
I fear very much that if there's no financial help and aid help for the Taliban, they're going to revert back to what they know and how to raise money. And that is first through the customs, the transportation, by fining them, taxing them. Secondly, by exploiting minerals and shipping minerals to neighboring countries. But thirdly, most dangerous of all, would be falling back on the drugs trade.
Laura Miller, what do you think?
They're essentially holding the Afghan people hostage to a certain extent, but the international community is too. The Taliban on their side are saying, what can we do? Give us support, or you're going to see the drugs trade go up, you're going to see migration go up, you're going to see the Afghan people suffering, and they're not doing much to try to make themselves appealing to the international community as an object of support. On the other hand, the international community is holding the Afghan population hostage by saying, we don't like the government that is in fact governing you now, and so you are going to be penalized for that fact.
Ashley Jackson, that's a very clear summary of the problem. Is there a way around it, i.e. by the international community funding Afghan people directly through agencies and bypassing funding the Taliban?
Not really, no. I mean, before I move on to that, I want to touch on Ahmed's point. It is hard to imagine a more counterproductive policy towards Afghanistan than the one that the US, UK, and EU nations are pursuing now. If you want to radicalize Afghanistan, if you want to drive up migration and drugs trade, this is exactly what you do. Now, there's been a lot of hand-wringing among the international community, very little action, a lot of talk about funding UN agencies to provide basic services. Well, that would only make the Afghan state even more aid-dependent, even more dependent on Western funds. And the idea that you can fund an education system without the state is a very misleading one. UN agencies could, in fact, provide more services, but they can't do that if sanctions are still in place. You know, they're struggling with a liquidity crisis as well. So you have to really deal with the sanctions regime. You have to recognize that you have to work with the sort of technical ministries, health, education, and that it won't necessarily benefit the Taliban. You know, those ministries serve the Afghan people, and the Afghan people are not naive. They don't think the Taliban is terribly competent or able to solve this crisis on its own. They will recognize that the international community has stepped in. And I think that's really important.
Let's look now, Ahmed Rashid, at Afghanistan's neighbors and what their policies are. Now, are they helping out at all?
In small quantities, the neighbors have been providing aid. Iran, Pakistan, India, and some of the Central Asian states. So there has been a small flow, but the suspicion is that a lot of this flow will be held by the Taliban for their own fighters. Because remember, the Taliban militia has to be fed as well as the ordinary people. So we really are seeing a slightly more helpful attitude by the neighbors. There was the possibility that the neighbors would insist upon an early recognition of the Taliban regime. But I think now they've backed off that and they've accepted the fact that there will be a recognition by everyone, not just a few countries.
Laura Miller, what about China? It's obviously hugely able to invest in Afghanistan if it wanted to. Does it want to?
China has at the senior most levels said explicitly that they believe that the countries that should pay for the situation in Afghanistan now are the United States and NATO countries, the ones that sent troops there. So they've signaled that they are not likely to be very helpful. The kind of aid that we are all saying is lacking and is not currently flowing to Afghanistan, either from Western donors or the region, is aid to enable public services to operate, the kinds of aid that would prevent a failed state in Afghanistan. That is not coming from any direction currently, whether China as the wealthiest of the regional countries or Russia, which also claims to have stakes in Afghan stability, will at some stage come through with some additional aid, I think is uncertain. They may be waiting to see what the West does, but these are countries that are not generally generous donors in the sense of, you know, true outright aid as opposed to investment that also benefits them. So I'm not particularly optimistic that we're going to see more than diplomatic activity from China and the other regional powers, plus a narrative of blaming the West for the current situation and for failing to pay for the consequences.
Ashley Jackson, we have to draw this discussion to a close. So I want to ask you this. How much worse do you think things can get? And who's going to feel the ramifications of it?
Yeah, it's really hard to envision. You know, when we last spoke about all of this, I am a pessimist and I would not have predicted this. You know, the U.S., the absolute lack of political courage and leadership to address this crisis. The U.S. could stop Afghans starving to death tomorrow if it wanted. But instead, we're sitting here and a million Afghan children are at risk of dying of starvation if they don't get aid right now. And I think, how much worse could it get? It can always get worse in Afghanistan beyond what we could possibly imagine. But I think the most difficult thing to sit here right now and grapple with is that this is entirely preventable.
Ahmed Rashid, same question.
Well, I think, you know, the political factor is also very important as to how the Taliban are going to get their own act together internally and whether they're going to actually pursue the most important Western demand, which is that the Taliban rein in some of these other militant groups that are living in Afghanistan, such as Al-Qaeda and other such groups. So the politics of the Taliban are going to be very important in order to win Western support, Western sympathy, etc. But Ashley is perfectly right that the West has really let down, so far at least, they've let down the Afghan people in huge dimensions.
Laurel Miller.
Afghanistan has a tendency of proving the worst case scenario predictions correct. And at the moment, the worst case scenario predictions are quite dire. As Ashley referenced, there's an estimate that a million children could die this winter who otherwise wouldn't if urgent steps were taken. There's a prediction that by middle of next year, we could see 97% of the Afghan population below the poverty line, below an already low poverty line, what's referred to as universal poverty. We are seeing public services collapse in the country, civil servants not being paid, and at some point they're going to have to simply leave their jobs in hospitals, in schools, in the power company, and all of those services will simply fall apart. So it could certainly get a lot worse, not worse than is predicted, just as predicted, which is pretty bad.
Laurel Miller there with Ahmed Rashid and Ashley Jackson. And my conclusion is that I heard what you heard, and it wasn't optimistic, and it won't be easy. My thanks to Mike Martin, Laurel Miller, Sukunda Kamani, Ahmed Rashid and Ashley Jackson. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Ben Carter and Kirsty Knight. The sound engineer was Graham Puttyfoot and the editor is Richard Varden. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently, we've unpicked what a variant is and how dangerous a new one might be. We've swum through questions about the state of our rivers, and we've explored China's economic woes.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.